Hello and welcome to Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. This is the second instalment on the 2014 HSC. This is the final year of school astrophysics section exam, where I talk you through. This is obviously a second generation or type 2 of a podcast where I give the lecture first, a little talk first, then go through the formulas again and again, and then start to work through some of the problems. So the little talk will be not all about astrophysics, but some aspects of astrophysics, and to do with the dynamics of stars, and also the HR diagram, the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. So stars are big objects, they burn fuel. What I'm going to do is actually just give a high level talk on them rather than actually simplify it. So they have, they're spherical because of gravity. They have inside them a core, which is defined where the nuclear fusion happens, and then they have a shell where the nuclear it's not so hot, the nuclear fusion doesn't occur. This is where the fuel is stored and goes up to the surface. So it's got a fundamental structure of a star, of a core. Now, in very tiny stars, very small stars, the pressure is not so great, and the entire star itself is a continuous convection zone. That is, the plasma is not sufficiently condensed or pressurized, so it behaves in such a way that if it gets hotter, it expands, and being hotter and expanding is the two things for it's necessary for it to reduce in density. If it's reduced in density in the gravitational field, an area which is reduced density is displaced, because higher density materials above it, that will tend to fall down and create a convection process. So in very small stars, you have convection all the way through to the core. And then in stars like our own, as they get progressively bigger, you have an internal region where convection stops, because the pressure is such that convection is not supported. Convection stops, and if you can imagine a jelly or a solid powder that you can actually move through if you really want to push yourself through, but these are incredibly high densities, I think 23 times the density of water. So this is a density far, far and above normal steel and normal matter. And this doesn't move or flow, it's perfectly stationary. And this is the radiative zone. And so what happens is that it heats up, and by black body radiation, it just emits radiation almost no distance to the point next to it. And this is the transport of heat by body containing protons, helium nuclei, various nuclei that are burned, electrons, and also a significant amount of photons, which are trapped, light trapped in a... this is a general lecture. I'm not aiming it for HSC. You get a similar thing is if you heat up a rock and from a fire, not a river stone, because that'll blow up a rock, and you then crack it open, you'll see that it's hot inside. The inner side is hot, similarly to if you've got a potato. You've heated up a potato, it can cool on the outside, but you bite into it, it can be quite hot on the inside. And that's the heat is travelling out from that. It's very stationary. So most stars are potatoes. So our star is two-thirds potato, or 80% potato, and the outer 20% or 30% is the convection layer, where the pressure drops again and convection can start up. And this creates a shear layer between the liquid convection layer and the essentially solid radiative layer. that shear creates a magnetic field. The magnetic field creates vibrations and heats up what is known as the chromosphere, the gas there, and heats it up in progressive stages till it creates a solar wind. And so when stars ignite in their nebula, dusty nebula, when they first start, one of the first things you see them doing is blowing away the material which is falling into them. The solar wind pushes this away, and this means a reactive process, and so this burns down. The solar wind pushes out, but it also burns down, exposing what we call a reasonably high density photosphere, which is the sphere that you can see at this point in time. Above that, the temperature suddenly climbs to the chromosphere, and we are actually orbiting in the very tenuous atmosphere of our sun. The atmosphere extends way out to us. If you can explain it, the in terms of atmospheric dynamics, things go up and fall back. So it is, in fact, falling back. It hits a shock wave when the expanding gas eventually catches up with the galactic gas, and there's a big galactic gas, and this is, I suppose, an important point. So in the galaxy, there's things exploding up, shock waves going all the place, and there's continuous star formation. So stars are being formed all the time. Our star itself is a second generation star. The universe is 13.8 billion years old, and our star is only 4.5 billion years old, with life beginning on our Earth, or 5 to 4.5, life beginning on our Earth very, very soon after, say, 4 to 3 billion years ago, the first single cell organisms emerged as our archaea, the ancient cells. We'll go back into this. What can happen is that you can have pressure waves from the surface going in, creating heat. And the pressure wave then creates heat, and then there's a shock wave which goes back out to the star, and it causes the star to oscillate in brightness. So our star, for instance, our star is a variable star. You may not believe it, but it is an actual variable star. Two ways it's variable: it's slowly getting hotter as the core is getting denser and burning more efficiently. There's a slow build-up of more efficient cycles than our sun, so our sun is heating up quite significantly, and so our Earth will be roasted to a crisp way before the sun expands and scales to cause us any problems. So over the lifetime of our existence, the sun's, I believe, got 25% hotter. I don't know how they calculate that exactly, whether that refers to the emergence of multicellular life about 500 million years ago, or it's a more recent dinosaur type thing. But our sun is getting significantly hotter, and we've got a condition of trying to keep cooler. So that's a variation. But our sun also has a 13-year solar cycle, in which there is a system that the magnetic fields get twisted due to differential rotation between the equatorial and polar convection currents, and this carries along with it magnetic field lines. And this is slightly different from the magnetic field lines you have from a fixed magnet that you would carry around the place in the school lab. These magnetic field lines are a cooperation between the magnetic field and plasma, which gets entrapped and shapes the magnetic field lines. Now, an example of plasma interacting and generating magnetic field lines, channeling magnetic field lines, would be a lightning bolt on Earth. The magnetic field lines tend to channel the plasma by creating a zeta pinch and pull the plasma down. But the plasma channel itself channels the current, which then for channels, there's a feedback loop, which leads to this phenomena of channeling and bending of field lines. You can't bend field lines in empty space. You have to have a plasma interacting with it to actually actually bend the field line. So it's a little bit of a complex thing. I believe they should actually refer to magnetically coupled plasma lines. I think that might be a better way to describe what's going on. But this process winds up, and the actual field on the sun becomes chaotic every 13 years in the solar cycle. And so our sun is a variable star due to this interaction. But you can have other interactions where the pressure wave travels at high speed, takes several days into the core, the increased acceleration in the core it would travel through again, pick up some energy, and the sun can actually ring and pulsate with pulsating energy waves anywhere from a month to days or even hours in some aspects of the sun. This is the normal sun. As you go up in size again, the above 1.4 solar masses, the unstable pressure waves can be such that the pressure waves help push nuclear fusion, couple to the nuclear fusion, and the star can oscillate, become unstable, and blow apart, creating a flash. There's various flash points as the nuclear fusion gets triggered. There's helium flashes, carbon flashes, as each element process goes on, but they can also flash as they go through a nebula stage. That's where a stage has coupled nuclear fusion on its shell. You get a nuclear powered pressure wave coming in, and you get recoil, and the shell of the star gets thrown off. Look, I should say at this particular point in time, my qualifications are really in quantum physics, laser physics, robotics, and just maths. And so I've been reading papers, modelling what these go on. And I don't know, people who write these up haven't read the papers, so don't describe it. So I'm not an authority on it. You can go to an astronomer and ask some more detailed questions about. Even people, plasma physicists that I know, don't really. They're working on nuclear fusion, but they don't necessarily know the ins and outs of the very high density plasma within a star. They're looking at very much lower density plasmas and very much higher temperatures. So they're actually building fusion reactors, Earth-like things, and they're way beyond the actual mechanism within a star, as far as I can gather. And there's knowledge of the plasma waves and plasma holding, but and the Alfan waves, which is transmits radio frequency, microwave frequency, heating of the plasma above the solar atmosphere. We should say that the solar atmosphere low temperature point, the lowest temperature point on a star, is the surface. As you work up from the surface, the temperature increases by a factor of 10 and thousands of times as you go up to produce the solar wind. And for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. As the wind is pushed forward, there's also a pressure of that pushing the wind forward, which pushes down on the solar atmosphere. So the photosphere is what you can see. You can see the convection cells in it, but above that is a much more tenuous atmosphere of superheated gas called the chromosphere. You can see the chromosphere by applying a hydrogen Balmer filter, Lyman alpha, Balmer alpha filter, which is the red filter, and Balmer, I can't really pronounce that, I've never spoken to people, I've only ever read that, the Balmer filter, and that cuts out the photosphere, and you can see the chromosphere on the sun, and you can see all this atmosphere, all these tornadoes happening and stuff like that. Whether you would feel too much wind at this atmospheric pressure, it's much lower than our atmosphere, these big tornadoes, we can definitely see it. And through that, you also get these massive ejections of the photosphere going up into the chromosphere in very visible arcs, where again, it's magnetic field lines coming out of the sun, but really it should be called magnetic and plasma field lines, that they interact together. You can't get one without the other. The plasma dynamics determines the orientation of the field lines. As you can see, these plasma flares go out from the sun. I'm just talking away here. So we're getting up to stars oscillating and stars blowing up, and you get basically these shock waves which hit a discontinuity of the photosphere. Various interfaces of sun density changes as they change from plasma state, so you get a tachosphere between the radiation and the convection zone. There's a surface similar to earthquakes on Earth. They reflect off the discontinuities between density waves, different speeds of waves travel across, but over different density you get a reflection process, and if you combine that reflection process with a explosive process, which actually causes basically a supernova, is a detonation. What more can you say? So a detonation involves a pressure shock wave. You can't really get out of that. Your little bullet or explosive grenades, you have a detonation wave which goes through and releases the explosion. So your entire sun explodes in a way, producing. Then you also have a neutron star. Neutron stars, the magnetic field is condensed or pinched into it, into a neutron star. So neutron stars have an intense magnetic field, but conservation of of angular momentum means that the neutron stars can actually oscillate at hundreds of times per second, and that's called a pulsar, as opposed to a quasar, which doesn't pulse. It's just very bright and a long way away. A quasar is a galaxy-wide catastrophe being swallowed up by a black hole. So the entire galaxy glows thousands of times brighter than the galaxy sitting next to it, because it's being consumed by a black hole and produces like that. Again, I've been in various talks or listened to various teachers explain it, and they just quietly tell students that a quasar is a very distant bright star, but it's actually in fact an entire galaxy. So the importance of this is I'm discussing stellar evolution, trying to get it across some of the basic physics behind it before we answer a stellar evolution story in here. Then we also have the idea of stellar evolution within a galaxy. So within the galactic disks, you have two things, star formation and star mixing. So in the galactic disk, you can have cluster of young stars being produced and continuously produced, and the stars get thrown away. So you get a general mix, you get a few old stars, but they get thrown into different areas. So clusters can be unstable due to the tidal forces within the star system itself, the formation overall, that you're seeing something that's very young. So you get gravitational instability and stars being thrown out. When we're talking about stars being thrown out, you can actually see a star moving away and backtrack and say, look, it came from that cluster. Similarly, we can see stars being thrown out of our galaxy, and stars from another galaxy landing in our galaxy and being caught. The way that it does it is you've got a binary star going into a black hole, and it's a bit like a slingshot. As we call it, a slingshot effect, one star gets sucked in, the next star gets thrown out at high velocity. This is opposed to globular clusters, which are sort of micro-galaxies which orbit our galaxy outside a tidal ripout limit. There's a limit, I forgot what the name of it is. There's a name for a thing. And so these are globular clusters, so there are just basically a Gaussian density of stars with essentially an ancient population of stars, and that is important because what happens is their HR diagram of a globular cluster is very important, because there are no young hot stars. Young hot stars have a very short lifetime, so they've already burnt out. So you can see a turnover effect and see the stars turn over and unnecessarily move from there. I think that's about the limit that I want to talk about. I've talked about stellar evolution. I should also talk about spectrum. So a spectra of a star is taken by taking the light from an individual star, isolating that spectra either by making the spectra directly on a photographic plate, by putting a diffraction gradient at a key point and actually spreading the light across, although that's not done, by filters. But more detailed, you siphon off the light from a star and actually put it through a one star only with some sort of aperture or optical fiber. Re-image that optical fiber as a single bright point. So if you ever get an optical fiber and hold it up to a light, you can actually see the light as a single point. So an artificial star. Take that through a spectrometer and actually measure that on the computer to get the... that's the way they do it nowadays. In the old days, we used to do it with plates to get across. Okay, so that finishes the talk on the astrophysics. As promised, I'll quickly go through the four formulas. You probably have heard them before. The first formula is D, the distance to the star in parsecs, equals 1 on P, which is the half angular distance between the sun and a particular point of movement, maximum movement. So in a 6-month period, at a particular date, the star will be at an extreme excursion, depending on how your orbit is and how you're looking at. And then 6 months later, it will be at another angle with respect to the fixed star background. At the background, that angle between the two positions of the star divided by 2 is P in parsec. Parsec is in arc seconds. A arc second degree, a degree is 3/60th of a circle. A minute of arc is 1/60th of a degree, and a second of arc is 1/60th of a minute. So that's very small. This goes into the next formula, which relates absolute magnitude, capital M, equals the observed magnitude, the relative magnitude, I think it's called, minus the following formula, 5 log base 10 into D divided by 10. D divided by 10 means that if you put in parsecs, the magic astronomical distance that all stars are put to is 10 parsecs, or 32 light years, 32.6 light years away. So our sun, which has got a magnitude, now remember that magnitudes are a Greek scale, so they had 1 being the brightest, and if something was 100 times dimmer, that would have 5. If it was 10,000 times dimmer, it would have a magnitude of 10. So a larger number means dimmer. So our sun has a brightness of minus 23 on the Greek scale, so it's incredibly, incredibly bright. So, and so if we were put our sun at 10 parsecs away and observe it from our sun, thing, it would have a magnitude of 4.2. So it's sort of a dimish type of star, whereas our brightest stars in the sky that we see, Sirius is, I think, minus. So this is in apparent magnitude, apparent brightness, as we see in the star, is minus 1.23, and Canopus, the second brightness star in the sky, as we see, is minus... I just have to really, really think about the actual brightnesses of it. I won't go on to that anymore. That's not going to help you too much. So this is an overall formula. I'll just read it. 5 log 10 D on 10 is all, that 5 and the D on 10 is all based to, comes out of a bit of modern telescopes and the ancient Greeks going to their star scale system. So we've selected, we've added difference to the ancient Greeks, the ancient star catalogues. We've tweaked our formulas to just agree with them. We also have a thing of, if we're measuring stars through a really good intensity measurer, each star, star A and star B, would have a ratio of intensities given by IA on IB equals, using the Greek formula again, 100 to the apparent magnitude of B minus the apparent magnitude of A, all scaled, divided by 5. And so if you had a 5 difference in magnitude, it's 100 to the 1. If it's a 10 difference of magnitude, it's 100 squared or 10,000 difference. Our final formula here, which we'll spend here, is for a binary star system consisting of two masses, M1 and M2. The combined mass, M1 plus M2, equals, from indifference to Kepler, 4 pi squared r cubed on the gravitational constant g, which is a very small number. I have to quite remember what it is. T squared. And the r cubed on t squared is Kepler's law, which is basically in revision again, that if you increase the radius by a factor, you increase the period by that by the same factor and an additional square root of that factor. Okay, that concludes the first two sections, which is the lecture and the formula revision. We come to our first question, which I now say, because if you've listened to the previous stuff, you'll be able to be out of the blue and not say, oh, where's this from, or if I learnt that. Okay. The question is, an astronomer has noticed that a star has become brighter. Explain two possible reasons for the change in brightness. Well, the first possible reason is that the star could have gone supernova. And if it's gone supernova, what's happened is you've had a nuclear detonation and the star is now burning all its fuel, remaining fuel, in about in a few days. It's a million years of fuel in days, so it's become a billion times brighter. It's also become much, much bigger. Another example is that you could have a astronomer has noticed a star has a star become brighter. I don't think a pulsar is really into it, because that's beeping so quickly. Another reason is it could be just a variable Cepheid star, in which the surface instability is sending pressure waves into the star and accelerating the heat transport. It's not necessarily the fusion transport. The fusion heat takes millions of years to get out of a star. It's the actual convection heat transport to come out of the star. But there's also pressure waves and stuff like that. And I should read the official answer for you for that one. It's 4 marks to clearly explains two possible reasons. The answer given out is the change in brightness could be due to a supernova if the change in brightness is extreme, sudden and temporary. This is due to a rapidly expanding shell. No, it's not the rapidly expanding shell. It's due to nuclear detonation. Another reason could be the star of a Cepheid variable. If it was a Cepheid, one would expect to observe distinct light curve increases and decreases in intensity over a period of a few days or weeks, as shown below. This is due to the expansion and contraction of the star. Okay, I might pay that one. Okay, we're going off to the next question here. It's question D. It says, a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, HR diagram, for a cluster of stars, and the spectral lines for the stars P and Q are shown below. So they have what looks to be the main... this is actually a bit confusing. Okay. Confusing to look at. But have the main sequence going up from M increasing with luminosity. You'd have to know what a main sequence is. Look that up in the net. And they have the letter Q for a star way beneath our star. Our star's at G. This would be a red dwarf. And its luminosity is significantly low. And then above it, it has a P in a red supergiant. Obviously, a very dim red supergiant. If it's got a spectral image of M. I suppose there are some red supergiants that are that cold. It's hard to imagine. And then it shows clusters for the P. They show very diffuse lines. There's no new lines there. I would have expected some lines, additional lines there, because you don't, if it's a cluster, if it's an open cluster, there's it's not. It's all first generation. There's no way that you can get iron metal lines in the actual. If you've got a red dwarf in a cluster, it'll be almost pure hydrogen. There'll be no chemical lines in it, but this one does. I don't know how that's there. That's the Q lines. The Q lines show that it's the density there. The lines appear to be, you can't really tell. It's just a grey photocopy. Okay, now the question is, explain how this data provides evidence of an evolutionary age of the stars in this cluster. So, well, this cluster is unlike an open cluster, which is just your Hertzberg-Russell diagram main sequence. This one's got a turnover point. Explain how the data, okay, so it's not just P and Q, it's the actual full cluster, explains the evolutionary age in this cluster. So reverse answering, this cluster shows it is a globular cluster because it shows a single population of stars which have aged by the turnover point, so the actual rollover point. Shown for here is the actual spectra at which it rolls over is the age of the cluster. So as the cluster ages, you start to lose stars up to the G section. So this is an old cluster, Yeah, so you can see the age of this is shown as a globular cluster, an old globular cluster which has turned over. There are no longer any stars at all left in the old sequence. And in fact, these are stars which beneath G's actually don't go upwards. They're all from the horizontal sequence. So I don't know whether this is actually concocted HR diagram or a real one. So it gives us the evolutionary age of the stars. It's all very old. So I think they will want us to talk about the P and Q star, except... Oh. Okay, so... they would want you to ask about P and Q, even though they have just only asked about the stars in this cluster. They would want you to refer to P and Q. Q is red because there's not enough hydrogen in it to or mass to increase the temperature of it, and P is red because it's expanded so large, is producing a large amount of light, but it's now gone to a very large state. So the actual process of denuding a star, of compressing its atmosphere, is switched off. This is the heating at the surface. P has thin emission lines. Its P is a bit of a mystery because it doesn't have the metals or other chemicals which would generate in here, but it is also consistent with a globular first generation star. Q shows some thickening and side bands in some of the spectra. I'd have to know where the spectral lines were, and that could be pressure broadening or magnetic Zeeman splitting of the lines, depending what those lines are. So the lines appear, the absorption lines appear thicker, so this has probably got a shell of cooler gas on the outside, and P is a more benign, sort of like glowing sphere of plasma. As we know, that P is a very large, low density star. Now let's go and actually read the answer provided for this. Go across here. And this is quite a bit of a story, so you're going to have to listen to this, but I promise you this will finish quickly. I imagine, look, if I had to answer this properly, it would take me 2 hours if I did all 5 questions. Let's go. In a cluster of stars, it is assumed that all stars are the same age as they form together. Well, in a globular cluster, it's there. Stars evolve when they run out of fuel. The brighter stars are larger. Their mass-luminosity relationship is shown, provides evidence for this. Okay, I don't quite understand that. Their mass-luminosity relationship provides evidence for this. Okay, the larger star burns faster, as shown, hence. So that's one thing I didn't say. The blue stars up there have burnt their fuel. I haven't said this answer too well. In the cluster, there are no hot blue main sequence stars. I've said that. The line in the HR diagram with no dots shows where the larger main sequence stars should have been. Well, there is no line in there, so I don't know what they're talking about. Oh, they would have drawn it. This provides evidence for the age of the stars. The clusters is presumably stars such as blue stars have evolved to red giants and then white dwarfs. There's no evidence of white dwarfs. By looking at where the stars turn off the main sequence, the age can be predicted. The age of the... Now, the age of the stars can be predicted. The age of the entire cluster can be predicted. In this cluster, the turn-off point is for the G stars, similar to our Sun. The Sun is expected to live about 10 billion years. The cluster is hence about 10 billion years old. That's actually quite cluey. The evidence for evolution can be found from the position on the HR diagram. Red giants are brighter than the red main sequence star. As they have the same colour, it's assumed they have the same temperature. Well, the surface temperature is the same. Looking at the spectrum more carefully, it can be seen that spectral lines are narrow, indicating the star is less dense than the main sequence star. Well, perhaps providing evidence that the star has expanded a part of the evolutionary process. Okay, the same information, but slightly different. Thanks for listening. It's quite a complex question to answer. And for 5 marks, it shows a thorough understanding of how the age of stars is determined. The age of a cluster is determined, okay. Identifies relevant features in the HR diagram and spectral lines, yep. Clearly shows how these relate to the evolution of stars. So I think I would have got 5 marks, but not clearly. And this requires you to do a lot of practice ready to answer these types of questions. Thanks for listening.